Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio. Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, December the 28th, 2021. And while the first hour is pre-recorded, our calling number is 563-999-3581, and you would press 1, and that would put you in queue. Dr. Tim is on vacation this week, and so we chose, instead of having a blank hour, to play some replays. The first three, yesterday's, today's, and tomorrow's, are all about the AA program and the 12 steps. And then we'll end the week with first century Aramaic forgiveness and why mind shifters. And so I hope you enjoy. This is the second pre-recorded show that we are doing in Dr. Tim's absence. And this is from December 2015. Thank you.
Well, thank you, dear heart. Thank you, everyone, who chooses to join us every day that you choose to join us. We are honored. And the fact that you lend a listening ear means this energy goes further and further afield every time you listen. And our purpose in doing this show is to provide a space of support for people to understand the first century Aramaic forgiveness process in particular, and how that fits into the dynamic of shifting life out of sadness, rage, fear, pain, drama, and trauma into living as we're designed to live as true human beings. And our definition of a human being is very simple, and that is hold a newborn child. You know what a human life is. That awesome, sweet presence of love is where we're each designed to live, and where, if we choose to engage in forgiveness, we can be living. Forgiveness being the removal of whatever belongs so that the restoration of what is designed to be running our lives is possible. So once again, welcome. Delighted that you're here. And we started the week off yesterday with some history with Gail and Dave and Dr. Tim. I'll share a little bit coming from the AA perspective. And our purpose in covering this conversation is we've, of course, along the way, run into and worked with a lot of people who've been in the AA tradition and who've gotten to a space where they live a clean and sober life. And so that being said, the thousands of people having been impacted by the AA traditions, the hope here is that the contribution that first century Aramaic forgiveness can make to those who are involved in those traditions, or those who, especially with family time coming up, might be facing some family dynamics and internal dynamics that they're not sure how to deal with. We want to be of support in helping to shift those dynamics from the rampant pain of the world and bring us back to the state of true beingness, back to the state of love. And provide the tools and the support for doing that. So we're honored that you're here with us. And Gail, are you there, young lady?
I am. I am here.
Well, good. Awesome. Well, we enjoyed your input yesterday. It was good to learn a little more of the history of the AA program and where it's been. And so I'm going to turn it over to you to give us the next level of your input on the correlation between the two, how First Century Aramaic forgiveness can be of support to people in AA, and how to bring the message of forgiveness and living truly as human beings. I was reading through a website that had some AA quotes in it, and one in particular struck me, and I thought it was kind of a cute little quip where it said, "I tried to drown my troubles, but the little buggers learned to swim."
So, that was good.
that was cute. So we invite people. It is, and invite people to let go of needing to drown their troubles and forgive them instead. So what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is, of course, after I got off the phone after the program yesterday, I obsessively went through everything that I thought about and discussed and said, and I saw some holes in some of the things, so I wanted to fill in some holes and some gaps.
Great.
And contribute some more of the influences that influenced the early founders to make the decisions that they made. And then if we still have time to talk about where I see the steps in the wake-up sheet or the worksheet and
cool. And
go from there. So
awesome.
Some of the holes.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people who have a lot of challenges in their lives do is they get stuck in this, what the world calls an obsessive-compulsive disorder. And we suggest that people who have that obsessive-compulsive disorder thing going, that they make a shift and where it can be of support for them in reviewing, rearranging, repairing something that they've done, that they turn their obsessive-compulsive disorder into an obsessive-compulsive blessing and forgive the rest. So we'll invite you to forgive any part of you that wants to make anything that you said anything other than perfect, and let's go for the next piece of the puzzle.
Okay, that works.
Cool.
What I wanted to offer is to backtrack a little bit with the conversation that Bill Wilson had with Dr. Bob Smith and how that changed everything. When
right.
he shifted into talking about his own drinking first to get some people to identify first with the problem, and then went
right.
on to talking about the spiritual solution. So that was one of the other things. And then the two of them went on to other people in Akron, Ohio from that summer to the fall. And that was when the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. It was in Akron. And the second group was formed in New York City. And the third group was formed in Cleveland, Ohio. And they decided that when carrying the message by word of mouth, that the message was changing. And they wanted to keep it pure. They wanted to keep the formula pure. And that they decided in 1937... to write the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellowship, there's two Alcoholics Anonymouses. There's the book, and that was written starting in 1937 to 1939 it was published. And how they wrote the book was that they had the 40 members that were staying sober. They had Bill Wilson dictate what he wanted in the book to a lady named Ruth Hawk, and she worked for stock options. She typed out the manuscript, and when they would get so far or do a chapter, then they would send it out to the others, and then they would edit it and make comments, and then they came up with how it should be written, or, you know, a democracy on what should be in the book. It did get to the point where I've been in business meetings where alcoholics have made decisions for the group, and just trying to make a decision whether there should be a Pepsi machine or a Coke machine in a club, and that almost breaks up the group. So I can't imagine what that kind of process for writing a book would have been like. There's a lot of talk about that almost breaking up the groups, fighting over what should be in the book. So anyway, the book was finally published in 1939. There was several names for the book. They had a lot of influence with the chapter of James in the Bible. So they're thinking about calling themselves the James Group. They're thinking about calling themselves the Bill Wilson Movement. And that got, there was a lot of names, but they did come up with Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was the first time that the fellowship takes its name from the book. And they talk about the first 100 people by a time, the time that the book was published, that they had 100 members that were staying sober. So they said in the preface, they talk about this book has been written by 100 people, and you can't argue with 100 people. You could argue with one person that writes a book and talks about their opinions or their experience, but you can't argue with 100 people. So that was the purpose for doing that.
And I'll bet there've been alcoholics who've been able to argue with 100 people, though.
I'm sure there is too. A lot of women that take exception to the using God and the pronoun he has been argumented with a lot. I mean, I certainly did argue with that as well. And then I just got so beaten up that I didn't care. It's like, just tell me what to do and how to do it so I don't have to drink again. So go ahead.
One of the things you talked about yesterday, and it might help to give a definition of that, was that what empowered Bill ultimately to stay sober was a bright light spiritual experience. And in the AA tradition, is there a definition for that bright light spiritual experience?
There are two spiritual experiences that they talk about at the end of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Wilson had that bright light spiritual experience, and he describes it as when he was in the town's hospital drying out because he feared that he was going to have DTs and he did need to have a medical detox, that he felt like he was on a mountain and there was this endless wind that was blowing through him. That was his spiritual experience that he had. This spiritual experience that I had, based on starting this time around in sobriety, because I was around bouncing back and forth for a while, and then I finally got sober in 1999. And 6 weeks after coming back to AA, I was reading in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was reading in Bill's story. I could not relate to Bill Wilson at all because he was a man, first of all. He was very wealthy at one point in time, highly educated, came from a relatively wealthy background. He didn't have any children, and he had the perfect enabler, and I did not have an enabler. And I had children, and I didn't come from wealth. And so I finally read his book, or started to read his story, that's in the, and he talks about how Abby Thatcher was talking, having a conversation with him in his kitchen, and he talked about how he said, you can choose your own conception of God. And then the next five paragraphs that are in the book happened to me. He explains about the icy intellectual mountain, which he had been in under, finally melted. He was free at last. He figured that God did want to deal with people if only we would open ourselves up to them. And I'm not paraphrasing this perfectly. And so that experience happened to me. But what they talk about at the end of the book, they do have an appendix, and it's called, I believe, The Spiritual Experience. And they talk about two varieties of a spiritual experience, because people were starting to beat themselves up because they weren't having that bright light, sudden thing happened to them. And they were calling the second spiritual experience the educational variety. And what that means, the definition of that one would be more working the steps, doing spiritual things every day to widen your human experience, and then and just waking up a little bit at a time, you know, having a gradual change. And I've experienced both by working the steps, and I've had several bright light spiritual experiences since then, since that first one that I had. It didn't make me immune to working the rest of the steps. I did work the rest of the steps just because I had that one spiritual experience. My definition of a spiritual experience is close to the Course in Miracles, a change in perspective from love to fear. Is a miracle or a spiritual experience for me?
From fear to love?
Yeah, from fear to love, changing perception
right.
From fear to love. Did I say that wrong?
Yeah, you said from love to fear.
I'm sorry.
It's kind of bizarre, but everybody who falls into any kind of addiction does have the experience of the shift from fear or from love to fear. We all started out the same. To me, that's one of the most hopeful aspects of one doing their work is the truth of who we are and where we started is the same for everybody and will always be the same, and it will always be there, and it's never touched by any experience they have in the world. And there's this conversion that takes place from love to fear, and to me, this work is about creating another conversion. And you know, that word has been sort of usurped by religions as, I want you to join my church. But in fact, it is a conversion from a fear-based mind back to a love-based mind. That's really what all of the work is about. And the key step in doing that is to forgive, to let loose of the energy of fear long enough to let that connection to love be reestablished. And that really is what opens the door.
Agreed, and that's is something that happens in working the steps. It's also something that happens, especially looking in the inventory process. There's four things that are addressed in the inventory process, which is our step four. We look at our resentments, we look at our fear, we look at our sex conduct, and we also look at harms done to others, and then we talk about them in our step five, and six and seven, we start to release those. And we call them character defects and shortcomings. And the definition of a character defect and a shortcoming is based, it says in the 12-12, which is another piece of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, in step seven, it talks about the root of all of our character defects is self-centered fear. And it talks about how we are afraid that we're not going to get something that we want, or that we're going to lose something that we already have. And looking at the worksheet process, that tells me that are the goals. Those are the goals that we have for other people, is that we're going to lose something that we already have, or we're not going to get something that we want. So that was the bridge for me there. But it talks about fear quite a bit, that we are a very fear-based people, and that fear builds onto our resentments, and that we can't. We use Einstein's quotes. There's two Einstein quotes that we use a lot, is that insanity, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And the other one is that we can't find the solution in the mind that created the problem. I'm not saying that correctly. Yeah.
And solve a problem with the mind that created it.
Yeah, exactly. And trying to figure it out. And that's, alcoholics have a tendency to be very intelligent people, very resourceful, and we think we could think our way out of it. I definitely thought that I could think my way out of it for sure. And I never could.
I know for myself that whenever I've worked with people who have a challenge with alcohol and drugs, that my experience has been that, by and large, they are some of the sweetest people that I've never met. And they came in with such a tenderness. I'm always reminded of the song about Vincent Van Gogh and the line that says, "And this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you." And that when that being lands and there's nowhere to be acknowledged or to really land as the gentle spiritual being that they are, that's when the pain and the trauma begin and the rage and the fear take over and being is lost. And
protection.
Of course, yes. And the being is lost to all of the defenses, all of the offenses, all of the pain and the trauma. And one by one, those things need to be faced. And just to reinforce for anybody that might be new, the whole goal process, part of the process with the forgiveness from first century Aramaic is that recognizing that what drives perception, and if our perception is based in pain, it's because it's being driven by something. What always drives perception is goals. And as you say, there are two of the root ones are, I've got something, I'm afraid I'm going to lose it, or I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I want. And so the goal, when it links to hostility and fear, then it creates perceptions based in hostility or fear. And that tends to lead, in my experience, to so much pain that people sooner or later have to find themselves in anesthetic. And they experience alcohol as a relief from pain rather than the toxic substance that it is. I remember working with one woman several years ago down in Florida, and she was a housewife, and her husband was a hardworking, you know, 18-hour-a-day kind of guy, and they made a lot of money, and their routine was, you know, he'd come home for dinner at, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and they'd have two or three drinks and then a bottle of wine with dinner and two or three drinks afterward. Didn't classify themselves as alcoholics, but that was a seven-day-a-week routine. And when she started doing this work, she chose to give up alcohol. She just, you know, made that choice, not necessarily thinking of herself as an alcoholic, but realizing that it wasn't productive or supportive for her, decided to give it up. And it had been a period of about 5 years that she hadn't touched alcohol. And she shared with me in a private session that she had gone to a party and somebody offered her a drink of hard liquor. And she said, yeah, sure, why not? And she said that the alcohol no more than touched her lips, and she experienced it as razor blades in her kidneys. That was the sensation that she had. And my offering is that the reason why people have that attraction to alcohol is because they don't experience it as razor blades in their kidneys. There's so much pain that they experience it as relief from pain. You know, you take two molecules of alcohol and you take the water out, you've got ether. And people are anesthetized. So they experience being anesthetized and, you know, without awareness of pain, go, this is good stuff. But once one starts to forgive and remove their pain, then they'll experience that as the toxic substance that it is, and the attraction will just disappear. And I've seen people, you know, for years and years and years who don't necessarily go into a 12-step program really kick into the forgiveness process, and there comes a point where they just give up addictive substances because my take is they start to experience them as what they are rather than relief from the pain that they didn't know they had. So it's powerful when people start kicking in and the core of forgiveness, canceling goals, that then allows them to drop into the part of the mind that holds that kind of pain and directly bring the presence of love to that part of the mind to enhance healing. So it's powerful to watch that happen.
Agreed. One of the things that I've experienced, and by listening to speakers and being able to identify what the speakers are talking about, is alcoholics have a tendency to be very sensitive people, which is something that we're very sensitive. We just came into this world not wired, I would say with our wires exposed more than, I'm putting in air quotes, normal people. And so the need, since we're so sensitive, that the need to anesthetize seems to be more necessary. And one of the descriptions that I heard is that alcoholics have a tendency to have like this invisible spring in their gut, and it just gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And they use alcohol in order to release that spring. And another example that I've heard was about feeling like you were born with ground glass on the inside of the skin. And as soon as that first drink was taken, that alcohol seemed to smooth out the glass. And the best example that I heard, and this describes me to a T, is being 30 seconds from having a screaming fit and always feeling like having to have the bells and the whistles and the mirrors and the smoke and all that going on so people wouldn't get close and really see that emptiness. And that's what I felt like. I felt like I was just on a verge of a nervous breakdown all the time. And I can remember feeling this from probably the age of 4 or 5. And always feeling like that, and knowing when I took that first drink that I found something very magic that was going to calm all that down.
You mentioned yesterday, and I didn't get a chance to go back to it, that you remembered having your first drink at 5. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. My dad had a shiny Budweiser box in the bottom of the refrigerator, and he was reaching for a beer. My dad is not an alcoholic. He is a compulsive overeater, and I would just like to say that my first drug of choice is sugar, and that's something that I very much, that was, food is my first love. Sugar is my first love, and it's something that I went back to when you were talking about, when you're talking about the, reiterating what I said about the drunk squad of the alcoholics that were attending the group, when you're talking about cross addicting to nicotine and coffee, during meetings, as soon as alcohol and the drugs were gone, I went back to Pepsi and gained a lot of weight. And so Pepsi and sugar is definitely a struggle for me that I still deal with today. And it was a struggle down in Florida when we went to the Fresh and Raw, when they had the cans of soda behind the counter. There were several times when I wanted to sneak back there and grab one during the intensive.
Right.
But as for my first drink, my dad let me have a sip of his Budweiser, and it tasted horrible. But I remember the effect profoundly in what it did. But I didn't connect the dots to that until I got sober. And then I remember my next drink. And that was one of the things that I heard other people talk about when they talked about their first drink. Normal people don't remember the first time that they tried their parents' alcohol. You know, and so I'm like, oh, I must be an alcoholic if I remember this at 5. And if I remember that.
Yeah, that's powerful. It's powerful.
No.
So we're here to hold space for all of that to open and heal. Go ahead.
I guess the other things that I was going to offer about influence is the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. Was something that they used before they wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the key people that they turned to for that was Emmett Fox, who wrote a book called The Sermon on the Mount, where he takes the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, and he also takes the Lord's Prayer, and he breaks it down into what I would consider the Greek interpretation of those Beatitudes. And in the process of my search to find more of the divine in the 12-step program, I also read a book called The Plaza Heaven by Max Lucado, who is a Christian writer, and I was able to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and correlate that to the 12 steps. For me, being poor in spirit is to empty yourself out, and that speaks to me of powerlessness. To mourn, blessed be those that mourn, what that speaks to me as is my old ways don't work, and I need to mourn my old ways and do something different. And that's our step two, is to do something different. And so I just wanted to offer that as well. They use Emmett Fox's book as well as the Oxford Group, the Book of James in the Bible, the Beatitudes in the Bible, they used all of these different pieces, and I wanted to offer those pieces as well.
Yeah, that's one of the most powerful correlations from James. Is a very simple explanation that he gives to the reason for conflict with people, and that's what's going on inside of us. And where James says, and, you know, it's kind of one of the first messages of the forgiveness work, is to stop your denial. And that whenever we're in pain and we speak or think about someone else, then we have to hide the part of us that creates that pain. And that's our definition of denial. And that's one of the upfront messages for me, at least, from James. He says, stop your denial. You got to start to take responsibility. And that's a big one.
Absolutely. I think I filled in all the gaps for now that I felt like I needed to fill in yesterday or and
awesome.
Drew and other influences. So I think I'm complete with that. I didn't know if you wanted to pull other people into the conversation at this point or...
Well, let's check with Jeannie and see if there's anybody with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room to be aware of.
Nobody has their hand up, and David's in the chat room, but I don't see him on the switchboard. Dr. Tim is with us.
Okay, well, let's see what Dr. Tim has to share. What's exciting in your life, Tim?
Well, I'm sitting here with bated breath to hear what Gail has to say about the crossover and connection she's made, the ways that the 12-step process enriches what she's learned from Dr. Michael Rice's work and the forgiveness process and vice versa, where you see corollaries or crossovers.
That's right.
Well, let's touch into it then.
Well, we will proceed. what I saw in the worksheet process, and there's so many different carryovers at different times, too. I will start with step one. The step one in Alcoholics Anonymous is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Then there's a nice little dash, and then it says that our lives have become unmanageable. For me, my thoughts are that it says that we're powerless, that that is about the physical. It's about the physical allergy. For me, that's 10% of the problem. And it's also the effect. That's something that we discussed at Heartland during Laws of Living, cause and effect, and that it is a physical effect due to our thinking and our lives being unmanageable. For me, that is thinking, feeling, mental, and emotional. That's 90%. And it's the only step that talks about the problem. And also the rest of the steps, when we work the rest of the steps, then our thinking changes, then our feelings change, and then we start to connect to the God of our understanding, and we don't have to drink again. And so, and that's 90%, and that is cause. And, you know, just from Abraham Hicks, the new, well, not necessarily the new, but the reemergence of the law of attraction, is that we need to change cause instead of, you know, changing effects or changing effects for effects. So I see that anything that we're powerless over is always 10%, is always an effect. And anything that is unmanageable is about our thinking and feelings. And we drink over our feelings. We want to change how we feel. And to, since a thought comes first and then we have feelings, we need to change our thinking or we need to change the cause. And we're able to do that when we work the rest of the steps. How I see that correlated is, one, the steps in the worksheet process is that the problem is laid out in one. And when we, 1A, we put our name, 1B, we put down how we feel. But sometimes we don't know how we feel, so we look at what our thoughts are in 1D. And then we talk briefly about what happened, my story, and then object of attention. So I'm seeing that as correlating into step one, being the only piece of material that talks about the problem and the effort to change my thoughts or to recognize my thoughts in order to recognize how I feel in order for those to change in the rest of the worksheet. So should I stop here to see if there's any other comments right now? Or?
Well, I'd throw in the thought that when, you know, that denial game takes over, that's when we lose contact with the part of the mind that holds pain. And, of course, if we don't have contact with it, it's going to simply run rampant and leave us in that powerless place. And the behaviors, the perceptions that come out of a part of the mind that we hide from ourselves, and the staying in the process of denial is what keeps us locked in that cycle, because we can't honestly face what's hidden as long as we're in that denial place. As long as I'm talking about you and how you made me mad or you hurt me or that upset me or this disturbed me, then my denial keeps me separated from that part of my mind that holds my pain. And that's what I need to access to bring healing forward. And so the acknowledgement of powerlessness over what I can't give myself access to, I think, is really key. And so in step one, that's the whole process of laying out the, you know, who I think it's about, what's my object of attention, acknowledging myself as the truth of who I am as love, and then what are my thoughts, what are my feelings, what's the situation, really gives us an opening to start to look at the part that's powerless by simply admitting and acknowledging it. And so to me, that's kind of how step one correlates in that regard, and to recognize that, you know, this body-mind unit, the carbon-based memory system, has a purpose, and that's to make real who we are, to embody as love. And that can't happen very well if it's filled with all kinds of dissociated content that's unresolvable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I read down farther, and I looked at the I want to punishment, want to punish by, and I... as an alcoholic, for me, I appreciate this part so much, because I think that because somebody is not doing it my way, that I have the right to punish. And one of the things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, I heard a lot of old timers say, don't drink, don't drug, don't hit. And I'm like, what? Why, you know, why would you say that? And then it was explained, and everybody giggles, you know, don't drink, don't drug, don't hit. Damn. And it was explained that in order to punish somebody else or to have a confrontation, I would need to drink in order to loosen those inhibitions up. Or after I had a conversation or got into a fight with somebody else, then I would feel so much guilt, shame, and remorse that I'd need to drink. So then I was able to understand why old timers would say that in meetings. And so examining how I'd want to punish somebody, because I think I have the right when somebody doesn't do it my way to punish somebody else. And that's not right.
And of course, there's punish self as well, and there's the tie to the codependence issue, because that's a power person dynamic. You know, everybody who, in order to control what's going on in their lives, has to lash out at someone, whether they hit or verbally abuse or put down or whatever, is because they had a power person who did that, and they're just replicating that power person behavior. And the ability to access that dynamic and start to see where and to expose the hidden parts of the mind to love when in that power person dynamic becomes a very empowering process.
Understood. And then the bubble where we released, you know, I release and surrender myself, my feelings, onesie, my story and my thoughts and my punishment to love. I love how that is reiterated and recapped. And then I also, I do a little ceremony there where I'm releasing that in a visualization, releasing all that. And then I cancel my need to be right and to make up another story. Definitely looking at this is a story, and that I could very easily have another story, replace the story that I'm releasing. And that's something that we take care of in the inventory process as well. I really appreciate when you say, you know, 42 people, 87 times, that it's inside of me when I'm writing down in the inventory process who I have resentments against, because I might be writing down different names, but I'm basically writing down very similar situations that happen next. And it offers an opportunity to see how I'm manifesting the same story over and over again, just with different people.
Yeah, the tie, you know, in the fourth step with made that searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Each worksheet is, in fact, an inventory.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Even if I have one event and I do five worksheets around that particular event in a day, I'm inventorying the hidden parts of my mind and allowing myself to allow that to come back to awareness and the dynamics of that. So that's really key and in effect, in doing worksheets, it's an ongoing daily inventory. It's a fourth step. You know, virtually every day. And David has his hand up with a comment for us. David, how are you, sir?
Can you hear me okay?
You're loud and clear. Welcome.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot, Ms. Gail, for passing on all your experience, strength, and hope. It's wonderful. It's a good day today to be part of the solution. I said a lot of good things, and you were just saying that, you know, the management worksheet was like a fourth step. And, you know, my personal experience, those sides, you know, it's the management worksheet is all 12 steps. You know, it's basically living in 10, 11, and 12, which we're doing a personal inventory, and we're trying to find a power greater than ourselves through prayer and meditation, and then trying to help others. We're trying to practice these principles in all our affairs. In our book, the big book, which is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the preface it talks about that the book is the basic text, and it really saved my life, getting in and getting a sponsor and getting somebody to help show me the truth about myself, because I've been living in denial, living a lie. You talk about Pepsi, you know, and food. It's peanut butter and Long John donuts for me. But it's still corrupt data. That's the great thing is it is corrupt data. And even though I lived in the program and practiced the program for a long time, it's still the basic text. It doesn't mean it's the only text. We can go elsewhere to find to increase our spiritual path or our spiritualness, which is love and forgiveness. But he also mentioned, I think, Gail, about the first step we're powerless over our addiction, and it says in NA, AA it says powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives are unmanageable. You know, that dash means that there's a second thought coming, not something that pertains to the person, but there's an absolutely different thought coming. And the addiction is only mentioned in the first half of the first step. The remaining 11 and a half steps deal with my life becoming manageable.
Agreed. Thank you.
And
right.
You said it.
No, right
you said it. And that's what it is. And my problem, including my alcoholism, was my inability to have a relationship with another human being. I didn't know that at the time. I had a great relationship with the thoughts in my own head, but those were poison. And it led me around, and it made my life totally unmanageable. You know, my mind was controlling me instead of me controlling my mind. And this is where the forgiveness worksheets, you know, helps me along this path, plus all the other seminars that goes into the profiling of that worksheet, too. You know, the power person, and are you getting stressed and eating, and responsible communication, and mind shifting, and on and on and on. But and you mentioned that one quote and about doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is a form of insanity. And my mind goes to the left-hand column of the things that I've done that I'm ashamed of, and the right-hand column, which is all about the newborn, which is all about love. And when I'm in the right-hand column about all the negative stuff, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, it is insanity. But when I am just trying to get over in that human being side, that loving side, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, becomes progress, not perfection. And that's using the same words, but now the motives are different. My insides are different. It's away from my head and into my heart, and that's just a beautiful thing, you know, to discover that.
Powerful.
The other thing, all right. The other thing that you mentioned was about our emotions, and one of the big things, big tools I picked up from Dr. Rice and except others, you know, that drawbridge. Confusing the trigger with the mechanism.
Mm.
I always blame the trigger. And that relieved me of my responsibility. You know, as long as I could blame you, you know, then I was free. And then they told me that as long as I'm blaming somebody else, I'm codependent. Well, truth isn't right. You know, this doesn't make any sense at all. But that's you know what it all is, and it's on YouTube now. But there's a Father Martin Choktaw who talks about the first thing that goes when we take a drink or something in our comfort zone. The first thing that goes is my intellect, and what comes to the top is my emotions. So my first line of defense is gone. And now I'm relying on my emotions. If it feels good, I got to do it. It's got to be right. And throughout the years of my addiction, as my addiction gets worse, I'm doing everything on my feelings. And so he talked about it, Chalk talked about you've got emotion, you've got intellect over emotions. And that makes my life manageable. But as soon as I take a drink or a drug, the intellect goes away. The emotions come to the top. And now I've got emotion over intellect. Then down the road, I quit drinking and drugging, and I'm still sensitive. Why am I still sensitive? because the emotions I'm using are the emotions I learned while in that addictive slime. While I was high or inebriated. And the winds got real closer together at the end, so I was always looking for something to make me feel better. And I discovered through the program and through Dr. Rice's work that everything that makes me feel good when I'm in an alcoholic mind is temporary. It's not going to last. I'm going to be looking for it again in 5 minutes or an hour. The big book talks about you can't remember the humiliation of a week ago or a month ago. Well, that'd be pretty nice because I can remember not remembering that humiliation of this morning. So those are some things that I was thinking about when you were talking. In effect, in a box, it was required reading for one of the co-founders of AA, Dr. Bob, and it was me too, and that's another wonderful thing. So yeah, Emma Fox used to give these lectures in New York right down the street from where they had the AA meetings at Calvary Chapel. So after the AA, after the drug squad got through, Bob would go down. This is I am Emma Fox. And one of the guys that was an alcoholic, supposedly, his mother was one of the secretaries of Emma Fox. So, you know, we just don't know how this is going to unfold. But so anyway, I was listening, and it was all great. I think that's my two cents.
Thank you.
That was cool. Well, and one of the points you made there, Dave, was the one about how when I blame somebody else, I alleviate myself of responsibility, and I certainly seem to alleviate myself of responsibility. And then what I have left is all that pain, which, as long as I'm blaming somebody else, is unresolvable, and that's what makes my life unmanageable. So it's just an interesting circle, so I appreciate the way you brought that around.
Yeah, and we talk about, you know, the feel is real, but the why is a lie. And
yep,
when I started out, I got that from you, you know, that's cool. You know, when I started out on a worksheet, you know, my intention is to criticize and punish. And along through the way of that worksheet, I get to the point to where I really have to look at myself and then I'll screw up data. And then I got a choice to make. Do I want to be serene and happy and joyful? And what do I do next? Well, I got to connect with a power greater than myself and choose a goal for that. The person I'm at has to do. And as soon as I choose it, I have to cancel it. And then I go to my higher power and let them interject love back into it. So we can, and by the time it gets over, you know, my punishing line at first now is in love. And you talk about that nicely when we talk about, you know, Rockma and Cuba. And once both filters are set to love, that's absolute love. And what a way to go. Not there yet. That's why I got to keep coming back.
And it's a process. A lifetime of work, yes. You know, the habit of alcohol is not created in a day. I think it's a multi-generational process. And so, of course, it's not undone in a day. But the truth is that people, if they choose to pick up the tools, and again, especially with the holidays coming up and the free flow in many cases of alcohol and hostility and rage and guilt and old family dynamics, that one who chooses to use the tools can still participate in those family events and be in a centered, connected, loving space rather than impacted by the things around them through the things they've hidden from themselves. So the ownership of those parts of the mind are such a big key, and that to me is one of the reasons why the inventory aspect of the worksheet is so powerful, that one can
own and see, as they talk about in the fifth step, exactly where their error lies, that instead of living in blockage of truth, they can live in love of truth. And when I live in love of truth, instead of look what you did to me, I can step into, oh, my mind's telling me the lie. You know, if you feel it's the real, the why is the lie. My mind's telling me the lie that this is yours. And at this point, I can then really own the part of my mind that I've dissociated from. And that becomes the admission of the exact nature of my error. And loving truth, I can start to bring that error to truth. And in that is its dissolution. One of the things Course in Miracles talks about is bringing the world you do not want to the one that you do. And that's holding to that connection to love, that connection to a higher power, or as AA speaks of it, God as you know him to be. And that when we hold fast to that energy and maintain that, then we can bring everything that's based in error forward. And as that happens, that which is based in error, when it's based in truth, when it's based in truth, dissolves, disappears. And so it's a big key. I mean, the insight of being able to admit and to own the nature of the error is really a powerful piece in the puzzle.
Right. I'm gonna let you go and finish off the next 5 minutes. So I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay. We appreciate you. Blessings. Dr. Tim, any thoughts?
Just dittos. It's very, very nice to see the, although it's been difficult to hear the quality of the call sometimes, I'm following it. I'm hoping other people can. It's very nice to see that people are looking for similarities and overlaps between very strong, powerful systems that have helped many, many people. And I love this kind of discussion as opposed to, well, my system is right because of this, and your system is wrong because of that. I love the integrative factor of this call. I'm glad you're doing it.
Thank you.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's powerful that, you know, the beauty that there are so many places that truth is coming forward in the world, that we can be fed by all of them is pretty awesome. So, Gail, we're down to about 3 minutes. Any closing thoughts for today?
I appreciated everything Dave had to say, and he filled in a lot of the gaps of things that I thought, but it just didn't come out of my mouth. So I just appreciate the way he reiterated it and made it his own and presented it and offered it, and that was awesome. It went very well, and it made me rethink some things too and connect some more dots with the forgiveness process as well. And I agree with you that this is an inventory as well as all the steps. And I used to call the worksheet inventories for the longest time because I couldn't say worksheet. I'm like, I'm going to do another inventory. So yeah, agreed there too. And step 10 is do an inventory every day as well. So that is a part of that too. And I just wanted to recap by saying that. And I guess tomorrow we will continue to go down the sheet.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, we appreciate you and thank you for your willingness to be of support. Hey, Dr. Tim, we are down to the last minute or so, so we'll close this one out and just say that if you have a thought for us tomorrow, it'd be awesome if you'd put your hand up.
All right. So that was a pre-recording from 2015, and it is a message that is ever living. It's awesome. So really appreciate Gail and David and Tim and Michael having the discussion and talking about the AA program. While we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, I am going to just say again that this week the Course in Miracles lesson for the entire week is the same one, and it is, this holy instant would I give to you. be you in charge, for I would follow you, certain that your direction gives me peace. And I looked up a different page than the one that I was reading from yesterday that says, what is the holy instant? And it says it refers to one's choice to accept the energy of love over fear and unity over separation. It is a choice that can be made in a single moment, in that single instant, but then it also may require a lifetime of practice and repetition. So we are constantly learning, constantly choosing. You know, and there's actually a site, and my mind's not going to his name right at the moment, but it's Choose Again. And he's always, you know, talking about, you know, you make a choice, but then choose again. So, and let me just check. Michael may not be able to call in because I'm actually in as host. So let me do a switch here real quick if he's having a challenge getting in. Give me just one moment.
I'm in. I'm on.
Okay. You weren't showing up on the switchboard, so I thought maybe I might have to hang up.
No. Sometimes it lasts two host instances. Sometimes it doesn't. Thank you, dear heart. We're having another delightful day with Ari Rain. Thankful for feeling good and waking up in the morning after that bout of COVID, realizing that, in fact, by consciously interacting with COVID, it's actually been a gift for both of us that has truly upgraded our health. So interesting learning experience. And we're rolling down, winding down to the end of the year. We're on the bottom of page 178 of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again?
Shift your microphone just a little bit.
Okay, sweetheart, is that better?
Not good. Well, talk a little. Yes.
Okay. We'll chat a little bit. So I'm going to just jump right in. I think we've got a call coming in from Carrie, so I'm going to just read a little bit of the book, and then we'll jump on with Carrie and say hello. We haven't heard from Carrie in a long time on the show. She was a participant back several years ago. Oh, geez, she was on many, many, many days in a row, and we had lots of great conversations. She's doing some awesome work down in Mexico. And so let's just head to the top of page 178. We're on to step 11 on the worksheet with our character Richard, and reading a couple of paragraphs. So step 11, here's where one steps into gratitude. And looking to, you know, recognizing that whoever the object of attention is of the worksheet, the true nature, the true character of the being that we're interacting with is love. And the true nature and the true character of ourselves, no matter what the rage and fear and guilt and hallucinations, whatever is going on in the mind, no matter what it is, the truth behind it all is that we are each beings of love. And so the objective here now, having collapsed through forgiveness, the hostility and fear-based hallucination to the mind, getting the opportunity to return to that space of love and to will joining in that love with the person who perhaps moments ago we thought was the source of our pain and trauma. Of course, it's a huge hallucination to think that shy of somebody coming up and punching you in the nose, cancel the thought, somebody can cause you pain. Oh, yes, if there's pain in you, you know, anybody can resonate it. Anybody can move it for you. And if you live in denial, you'll believe that the pain is really caused by them. Oh, you really upset me when you did that. Excuse me. You've been upset. You're the one who's been upset every time you've been upset. I'm the one who's been upset every time I have been an upset. Maybe we need to start to suspect that if I'm an upset, it's mine, and it could be my opportunity to forgive, to remove that upset, the whole objective of the work, to get past all of the hallucinations of the mind. So we're inviting Richard. He's doing a worksheet on his sister, Amy. I'm grateful and join with the love in you, Amy. I acknowledge us for creating. And so we're in the process here of framing and setting new goals, going for something different than what the mind of hostility or fear would go for. And the mind of hostility or fear will always find a reason, always find a way to rationalize its hostility, its rage, its guilt, its grief, its pain, its trauma, its condemnation, cutting other people off of communication, because that's the world it lives in. That's its game. So here, the invitation is to set a goal from being, from recognizing yourself as love, and creating one, truth, two, perfect love. Interesting, you go back to the ancient Aramaic, and the phrase is used, perfect love casts out fear. What does that mean? Well, you remember that we've talked over and over again that Yeshua never said love your neighbor, never said love God as yourself. That was a total Greek, you know. If Yeshua sat in a church where they talked that talk, he'd say that's all Greek to me. But he said to have rachma for the creator and for your neighbor. And by so doing, you would maintain self. You would maintain love, the state of being that you are. And so to bring that to the forefront becomes key. There's a filter, and we've talked about this many times, over the frontal lobes of the brain. It's called rachma. It may well be what anatomically is called the angular, my brain's gone now, angular gyrus, as they're discovering. It seems to have many of the features and many of the functions anatomically that this filter called rachma has, and that there's a second filter. That one's over the frontal lobes, over intentions, and then there's a filter called kubba in Aramaic. Now, there's no such word or no such concept in our language for either of those words, but the closest we could come would be to say that it's a filter over perception. That allows only perception's key to love to be used, units of perceptual memory to be used by the mind in formulating your perceptual construct. So those two filters together set in the mind were what were referred to in Aramaic as perfect love. Again, no such concept in English. So when Rachma and Kubba are set, the mind is on track for that thing that was called in Aramaic perfect love, or the Greeks translated as that. And then to set a new goal, to frame, set a goal that you're willing to take action and create fulfillment of in your life. And so he's acknowledged that he's been distant with his sister Amy, that he had jealousy, that, you know, she had the easy life that he wished he'd had, and that he's always dissed her to some degree. And so his new goal in regard to his sister is to create a close, warm relationship and to choose to be available and responsible for his own feelings. And of course, there's a reminder there to breathe, because when we start treading new ground in the mind, when we start digging up the old drama and trauma-based mind, the tendency, the way to hold on to it is by cutting off and holding the breath. And so here, the opening of the breath, and, you know, really ties into the still point breathing process. It's such a huge key in doing this. By the way, we do have, if you go to our website, whyagain.org, there's a link to a flyer for our monthly Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing Club. So you can take a look at that if you're interested in joining us. It actually happens the second. We're doing it online via Zoom. We found it's working very well. We weren't sure that was going to work the same way as it did in person, but then when we did a couple of online intensives and the still point just went so powerfully, we went ahead and we did one, you know, just independent Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop, and that turned into a one-year commitment. So we're rocking with that if you're interested in joining us. It happens the second Saturday of each month at 10 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, and then on the Tuesday following that Saturday session at 7 in the evening Eastern Time, we're doing a second piece of that session. So each month we have those two sessions if you're interested in joining us. So, Richard ties into those new goals. He's going to join with the love and his sister, looking for that, connecting with that. You remember we talked about and it's such a great metaphor. There was an historian that I happened to run across who was doing a presentation, and he had coined a phrase called the Mr. Magoo syndrome. And if you remember the cartoon series of Mr. Magoo, Mr. Magoo is this character who's so nearsighted that he has no idea where he is, and he's always fantasizing somewhere other than where he is. And the hilarity of the situations he gets himself in, you know, he thinks he's one thing and, you know, doing something, and he's doing something totally different, and he thinks he's in a certain place, and he's someplace completely different. So he's going through life with no idea of who he is or where he is, kind of like most human beings, not realizing that they are love and that they're going through opportunities to learn forgiveness. People think they're rage and fear and guilt and grief and pain and drama and trauma and disease and suffering, and they're going through being punished and hurt and picked on, and, you know, it's really the Mr. Magoo syndrome. So this is the place to withdraw from the Mr. Magoo syndrome and realize that you are walking through life as the active presence of love. If you don't experience yourself as that way, then there's a part of you that needs to be forgiven. And forgiven here doesn't mean let off the hook for that error. Forgiven means remove those parts of self. You remember Yeshua 2,000 years ago says, in order for you to live, you've got to die. The self you're not, the Mr. Magoo self, has got to go. That's what he was saying, in essence, 2,000 years ago. And I don't remember the historian's name at this moment, but I thank him for that metaphor of Mr. Magoo, the Mr. Magoo syndrome. So this is a place to let go of yourself and all the beliefs you've got in weakness and frailty and victimhood and all the non-human stuff that goes on in the mind, and claim the truth about yourself. So Richard kicks in and says, relief and hope are what I feel now. It seems I've learned so much about myself, more than I've learned in my whole lifetime. What can I do for you, Michael? Richard, there's a principle in physics called critical mass. It is the threshold point where seemingly small action transforms a large mass. Without charge to the sponsor, we accept every invitation possible to speak to groups. We present our travel workshops free and invite people to copy and give away our materials so that our work is available without regard for the ability to pay. We do these things as our contribution to creating a critical mass with these tools. And, of course, we ask people, so that we maintain the integrity of the work, to acknowledge where the ideas come from so that we can keep extending this process. We've had some people who will pick it up and take it off and pretend it's their own. And there are two things that are deleterious about that. One, people oftentimes, like, for instance, over the years, I've had many people they've created their own worksheet. And sometimes they'll send me a copy of it. And 9 out of 10 times, the key core step of forgiveness is left out of the worksheet. There's one gentleman who wrote a book. The first version of the book that he wrote, I mean, he came to one of my workshops. He took the worksheet and he wrote a book on it. Created his own worksheet based on mine, except that he left forgiveness out. And he called it forgiveness, but there's no forgiveness in his worksheet or in what he's doing. So that's one deleterious effect. And two, that we've got a momentum toward this critical mass, and we're asking those who pick up this work and see its value and its benefit to be part of extending that critical mass by staying connected with us in that regard. So what can you do for me, Richard? Doing your work and sharing with others will add energy to our family's commitment to deliver these tools to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. It's the greatest gift you could give us. We also invite you to support the work financially or any other way you can, if that's a possibility and a desire. There is always work to be done at Heartland, and the donation of materials or labor are always welcome. Of course, doing and passing on the work is most important. And, you know, what our commitment is about is taking this to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. If you don't have the forgiveness app yet, Jeannie just did a whole other upgrade. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of hours Jeannie has put into this app, and it was usually at 5 in the morning when she'd be on the phone with the techs in India to bring the app forward. But download the app from your app store. Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, just type that into your app store and you'll be downloading the world's only forgiveness app. And Jeannie's just added so much functionality to it. Get on it, explore it. You can ask questions directly from the app. There's just so much in it. It's awesome the way it's coming together. And support us in making it available, putting it out there, extending it on a wider and wider scale on a planetary level. So that's how you can support us. Do your work, number one. Two, pass it on, number two. Three, hey, if there's some way you can support us, you know, you're a millionaire, hey, tithe, go ahead. You're only worth $10? Great, tithe the penny, you know, whatever it takes. It isn't about the money. Of course, you know, when we travel and we pay our own expenses, we're not traveling right now, and we pay our own expenses, we do those workshops free. Although we haven't figured out how to do them for nothing yet, so we do invite people to donate. And so if this is benefiting you and working for you, you know, maybe you're at the end of the year and you need to unload some money for your taxes, great. Go to our website, whyagain.org. There's a donate button. Click and go for it. Beyond that, pass it along. And so Miss Jeannie, is Carrie with us? She was going to be calling in from Mexico, I think.
There is a long number that she doesn't have her hand up, but I'm going to click it and see. Is this Carrie? Are you on?
Hi, me. Yes, it is.
Hey.
Well, hey, young lady. Hey. Delighted to hear your voice.
Yeah, hey, with Jeannie, I couldn't remember how to put my hand up.
that's okay. You press one, but I wasn't sure with it being an out-of-country number whether that would work for you. So.
Right. Cool. And Jeannie, oh my gosh, your work is so incredible. I've been just really admiring it. I've been digging around in the website, and we downloaded the app, and you've really done beautiful, beautiful work. It's amazing the way everything is presented.
Isn't that app
designed.
Fabulous?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I haven't dug into it very far yet, so I'll report back more after we do. But, yeah, it's so beautiful.
Sweet.
And, yeah. So, and it's great to hear both your voices, and I send you so much love and appreciation. I'm going to cry.
Received. Received. Sounds like there's some emotion going for you right now. What's happening?
You know, I just am digging through the Aramaic, and it's just incredible. It's such a message for these times, and it's so important, and I just honor all the work you've done. It's amazing.
Thank you.
You know, over many years.
When I communicated... Right. When I communicated with you yesterday about the Aramaic alphabet, it was actually about, let's see, I think maybe 8 years ago now, we did a seven-country tour. We went to seven different countries. We started out in Sweden, then ended up in Denmark. It was kind of cool. In Denmark, we ended up invited to the birthday celebration held by the Danish Physics Association, it was the Nobel Prize Association that held a celebration in honor of the 100th year Eternal Day of
Niels Bohr.
I actually got to sleep. We actually got to sleep in his study. We stayed with his granddaughter, and we got to sleep in his study with all of his materials. It was really cool.
Oh,
but anyway, but about the fourth country we're in, there was just like this brain thing that happened for me. It's like, you know, I listen to the Swedes and these, you know, frequencies come out of their mouths and other people understand what they're saying, and then I don't understand a thing, and then I listen to the Danes and this Danish sounds come out of their mouths and other people understand, and then we were in Portugal and, you know, these voices in Portuguese, and then and there was a point where it was like, oh my God, this is all babble. You know, the Swedes, they made up some grunts and groans and called them words, and we who speak English made up grunts, and we're doing babble right now. This is based in nothing except somebody had a fantasy that the word is going to represent a thing we call a word, and, you know, and we made this all up, and it just experientially really struck me as this is babble. There's only one language that is based in the physics of the world, and if you look at the letters of the Aramaic alphabet, they're actually images of 3D shadows of the movement of the atomic elements.
Oh my God, that is
the world
amazing.
Of physics. And it was just like, it was sort of like I had this aha moment of, oh my God, we're trying to make up words that represent some semblance of what's actually going on, but there is a language that's based in the physics of the world. And, you know, the 3D shadow of
the
actual elements.
Physics.
Yes. So carbon, you know, all of these different molecules or atomic structures as they move, if you were taking a 3D picture, that would be the Aramaic alphabet.
And what I shared with you was, I just sat looking at some of the files that are on your website, you know, of the actual pages of the Aramaic, and I was literally feeling this energy going through my body, particularly to my heart. You know, I was feeling just currents going through me as I looked at it, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm actually feeling a vibration from this language. And then you wrote me back that. I think that's just incredible.
And then when you realize that at least five of the world's major religions came out of the Aramaic,
right,
there's a reason. Not a reason. It's not that it's a religious language. It's the fact of how the world works. Men turned it into religions in each case, and now the game becomes control and, you know, dogmas and doctrines and all that. But they were each, here's the truth of how the energy system called life works. And
right.
And what the, in the Aramaic, what they called, what the Greeks ended up calling law, you know, the Greeks took the idea over and they made it into, well, law is the rule of a superior. There's this superior that's really going to get pissed with you if you don't do what he told you to do. And in Aramaic, the word law is actually, and we don't have a concept in our culture really for the word law, aside from the rule of a superior, but law is simply, here's how it works. You know, when they say to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? They're talking about in living a human life. He says, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. And he says, what's most important is you got to have Rachma active in your mind. If you've got this gateway open, then love is active in your physiology. That's how it works. That's the law. It's not you've got to, you know, be this or that or the next thing. It's such a whole different game, such a whole different thing than the Babel languages have made it up to be.
Yes. I've also found I've been learning Spanish, and my husband just said, I've been experiencing that with Spanish, that it's another one of those. It's like Babel. It is in many ways. It's like a slave language. It incorporates the beliefs, you know, of blame and superiority and all those kind of things. And I was going to say, too, I kind of was feeling, you know, what are the tears about? And really, it's just that I feel this teaching is so powerful, and it's the tears of the contrast of the world, you know, and what every day we live and walk and talk. And we really have a practice in our home of of choosing to live these principles, and we talk about them every day. And just that desire to, you know, to immerse it into the world, it's just, and sometimes feeling like it's overwhelming, I think.
I hear you.
It's the gratitude. That it's the gratitude, too. Like my husband tells me, I threw him a rope. He was in the ditch. and he thanks me for that. And is that what you say, babe?
Well, it's a lifeline. Hi, hello, hi, everybody.
Hey, the light to connect.
A lifeline, like the Wonder Woman line of light, the line of truth, the line of power. And I had the choice of taking hold of that or not, and I'm still holding on, let me tell you.
And I feel like you've done that, Michael. Like, you've thrown out a lifeline with, like, you and I have known each other since 1980 probably, so 40 years, 40-some years.
79 or 80 was, the first time we connected.
Right. And then I know your history before that, and just that you came in touch with this work and you made the choice to make it your life's work. And it's just a gratitude for that. I'm kind of crying.
I hear you. Well, you know, I was saying to you a little bit, and I don't want to get into the topic too much, but the gifts that we've both been experiencing from having had COVID just very recently, and you know, we're still being quiet, we're not running any marathons or anything, but we're past the quarantine date and our granddaughter is back with us and that sort of thing. But we've both of us found that with the tweaking of our immunity, realizing that it's moved some underlying energetic patterns and thought processes. And, you know, one of the things we do as our entertainment is we watch movies, and we've watched, actually both of us, there have been several things that we've watched since the whole COVID thing started. And we'll be, you know, we've got a large screen TV in our bedroom, and we'll be laying watching this. And I'll be reaching for a Kleenex and dabbing my eyes, and Jeannie will be reaching for a Kleenex and dabbing her eyes. And we'll both be sitting here in the same kind of tears that you're talking about when, you know, this film expresses, especially the ones that are true life things, expresses the actual operation of human life, the actual presence of love and people functioning out of the integrity that love is, that our true being is. And it's moved a lot of that same kind of emotion and energy that I heard in your voice that just a few minutes ago. So I'm fully with you. I understand it.
Yeah. I don't want to get off on movies, but there's a great movie, Te Ata, about a Native American woman who did storytelling for 100 years. She lived 100 years. She just died recently. But she, in the face of really abuse of her culture, she told stories, and she was invited to the White House, and it's an amazing one. Amazing film if you get a chance to watch it.
Spell it for me if you would.
Sure.
Really? Spell the name of it?
Te Ata.
T-E.
So the letter K,
A-T-A?
Cool. We'll watch it. We'll find it.
A-T-A.
Yeah, it's really amazing. It's an amazing expression of that living in love. You know, it's really, really, really good that way.
Sweet.
And we cried all the way.
Cool.
But I want to come back to the Aramaic because I just am delving into this. I'm going to teach a workshop at a retreat in January, and it's basically it's on the. I wrote books called 21st Century Superhuman, and it's kind of about the theme of those books that were in the Great Shift of the Ages. But as I began digging in, the direction I've been going is to, I'm actually making a slideshow with little, and of course I always acknowledge you. I always talk about your website. We'll talk about the app. And it'll be a nice little group to get it out to on a bigger scale. And it'll be a really interested audience. So I'm really making some slides with the different precepts on it.
Great.
I just, Yeah, and so I've been digging into everything you've got written about the Aramaic, and I'm just I want to ask you a few questions. One is,
go for it.
I know the whole Kubor's manuscript is like 500 pages, right?
About that, yeah.
Yeah, and so have all those. So I want to know, when I look at that writing and you say it's the shadows of the elements in physics, the letters are, and you talk in some of your explanation about how they had to add vowels because vowels were not in the Aramaic shorthand. So in the Kabur, I'm guessing those vowels are not added yet, right?
Correct.
Is that correct? Or okay.
Yes.
And then the group who... Is the group still working on translation? I mean, has that whole 500 pages been translated or no? Am I going to have to figure out how to translate it myself? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Unfortunately, it has not yet been translated. And basically what happened was that there were 25 of the world's top Rameses back in the 70s that worked on the Kabor's manuscript. A partner of mine had sent an expedition to the Middle East. It's called the Kabor's because it was found at a monastery on the Kaibor River in Turkey. And so 25 different translators worked on this translation work. And it wasn't, even if all 25 translators, agreed on the meaning of a word or a phrase or a concept, it wasn't considered valid until it actually was taken into the laboratory, the classroom, and it worked. It produced the result that it purported to produce. Unfortunately, that project ran out of money back in the 70s, so there's been no translation work done since that occurred. My partner in the project passed away. And the project was passed on, and I became director of the project. And there's been so much work to do to just take what we know so far and put it out there, make it available, get it to the point where it becomes a strong enough frequency in the culture that it easily available, that it expands on itself.
Right.
And that's basically what I've been working on. And so there's no actual translation work that's been done. The translation work that has been completed so far is in that book I told you about called Enlightenment. And if you want to send me your address, I'll send you a copy. In the back, it's actually a three-part book. The front of the book is some of the story of the manuscript. The center of the book is some select passages from the New Testament, and the key words are left in Aramaic in those passages. And then in the back of the dictionary, or the back of the book, there's a first century dictionary. These 25 translators worked as diligently as possible to establish actual first century meanings of the words. Sadly, there are other translations from the Aramaic out there, but most of them were done by people who were influenced by the Greek, you know, in many cases, the Greek translations were translated back into Aramaic, and the people who were working on it were influenced by this church or this dogma or that dogma.
Right.
And so they've been tainted in the only way, you know, that the Kabor's Foundation that we established, yes, we will say this is the meaning of this word, was when it produced the result. And so that first century dictionary has what we found so far, and it hasn't come up to the level where there's been the kind of funding that it takes to take the translation work to the next level. And I really have no way at this point to quantify how much of it has been translated. You know, we've got what we've got at this point, and it's been all that I could do to take it and to keep moving it forward, developing products, you know, such as the app, the website, to make it available to people, to keep giving it away and expanding it.
Well, it's amazing that you managed to pull the themes from it that you did. And was that partly from the work of Dan or?
Yes.
I mean,
A great deal of it.
ahead.
A great deal of it came from Dan. Dan, when we met, had created a thing called Emotional Maturity Instruction out of that work and took it into the prison system. When Dan and I met,
right,
we found we'd been traveling similar pathways. I had developed a body of work called Lessons in Living. This goes back 40 years ago. We put that together and we created Laws of Living. We took those two bodies of work, melded them together, put in the nutrition and all of that, and that's called Laws of Living now, and that's something that, you know, I usually teach once a year. With COVID happening, I haven't done that. Actually, the last time I taught Laws of Living was about 3 weeks before COVID really exploded on the scene. We're looking at perhaps doing another online Laws of Living, but I've been working on that since Dan passed, which goes back now, I'm not even sure, probably 11 or 12 years, and each year been working on advancing it and getting a deeper understanding of it through the Laws of Living course.
Well, it seems like you have really some essential principles from the Aramaic, and how is it that you managed to distill those out?
Well, that's been, you know, once we, the translator said, here's what this word means, then
right,
we would take that into the classroom through Laws of Living, through Why Is This Happening to Me Again. That's where the original, you know, worksheet from Why Is This Happening to Me Again started. And through those two bodies of work, we would work with people and clarify, upgrade the principle, upgrade the understanding. And that was the work. Like Dan would come to Heartland every year, and we would actually, you know, back in the day when, you know, we didn't have cell phones that we could get on and talk forever and cost next to nothing, basically Dan and I would spend 2 to 3 hours a day on the phone in discussion with these things. My phone bill would run $1,000, $1,400, $1,500 a month to keep up the phone calls that we would do, and we would get together. He'd come to Heartland, and we'd teach Laws of Living there, and I would go to Albany, Georgia, where he was. There was a thing called the Judicial Service Agency, and they taught prisoners in the prison. It was actually promoted by a Superior Court judge named Asa D. Kelly. And so that's how we worked with and developed the body of work. And, you know, since Dan passed away, we just carried on with it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really amazing, and it's clean and clear principles. Yeah, it's incredible. Really good.
Well, the vibrations, the vibrations are transformative all by themselves.
Exactly.
Is my take on it. And the gratitude that we feel over and over is right up there in love. I mean, there's no delineating point between gratitude and love. It's all, it's like the colors blending into a rainbow with itself. It's all the same thing, really. And so enjoying that frequency. You know, crying during teyata was just delicious because it was so, the gratitude was so overflowing, and the love and the abundance of it just takes over the body. And
I'm with you.
Getting that repetitive feeling in the body and getting used to it and making that the new status point, the new place to be from.
Yes.
It's a journey. It's a walk of mastery. And that's what this work shows me anyway. It shows this walk of mastery and how far we have to go and how really corrupt what we've been given is so far.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Pure words mean.
And we know it's interesting. It's
you know, it's the rewiring of the brain structure. And it's beautiful. It's delicious to be in. And it's such an awesome world to be part of. To me, that's the new earth. That's the direction we're headed in, and that's where I'm going.
Well, and I think that taking it into earth, which means literally the rewiring of the genes, it's literally the whole genetic history that needs to be rewired from its insanity, and that's part and parcel of the process. It's interesting that it is suspected, although we don't know for sure, that the root of the Buddha's teachings was also Aramaic, and he comes up with still a third, you know, facet of the diamond and the facet he focused on, as opposed to, love, was compassion, and it's another aspect of being.
Right.
And, and so he brings, the Buddha brought another whole piece of the puzzle in where, the Greeks took it and went, oh, we need to own this. We need to get rid of everybody else. Only ours works. And, so here they sit with, 32,000 sects of so-called Christianity right now?
Right. The HeartMath Institute has demonstrated that when we go into compassion and gratitude, love, compassion, and gratitude, that we go into a state of heart coherence, and it changes us, and it changes the world around us. And ultimately,
it's being.
It's so simple, but it's really pure science.
Yeah. That's being. That's, one of the questions, and you maybe haven't heard me ask this in several years, but one of the first questions we ask when we do, why is this happening to me? Neither Jeannie or I will ask this question, is how many have ever held a newborn child? Go back to the moment where you held that newborn. Tap into the essence of the newborn and notice that the newborn isn't loving you. The newborn is love. And the objective is to get back to that. And we all come in exactly the same as love. And for most people, it gets beat out of them very quickly. And then they're given a false definition, a lie, and they're told to go out and find somebody to love them or somebody to love as though love was a verb. And when you give the mind incorrect definitions of words, people go off on a path that's going to produce no fruit whatsoever. Where the objective or the directive was to function as love.
Right. And when we're off track, it's ultimate, as it says in the Aramaic, it's ultimate disintegration of our being.
Yes. And the next piece of work to be done, to confront all of that and to recognize that held within our genetic structure is the memory of all of what the generations have done, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That story about the Jews wandering in the desert isn't about a 35-square-mile hot, sandy place. It's about functioning out of the unconsciousness held in the genes.
Yeah,
that's
right. And to get out of the desert is to get out of the unconscious condition. I don't believe that it is natural for a human being to have an unconscious mind. It's a total artificial creation that comes from us playing the game of blame. You made me mad. You made me sad. You made me afraid. Now I have to cut myself off. I have to dissociate from the part of my mind that creates those energetic patterns. And I have no idea that it belongs to me. Now I have a perceptual mind that constructs a world where now that I've blamed you, I literally see a picture, my mind generates a construct of you doing it to me. And I'm cut off from my own internal dynamics. And the forgiveness process is how we're restored and undo those unconscious dynamics so that we come back into whole function.
Yes, and that shift of forgiveness coming from the other to myself and cleaning out my own old data is a big shift in thinking, because we're so programmed to think of the other that the new shift is to go within self and to find all that old data and all that extraneous stuff within ourselves, and that ends up being true forgiveness. Beautiful.
Exactly. Beautiful. Exactly. And the only thing that creates diseases are dissociated unconscious energies that are stored wherever they're stored in the body. If a disease energy is stored in the big toe, the knee, the liver, the brain, the heart, then there's going to be the big toe, the liver, the brain, the heart disease. There's only one disease. That's a disintegrative energy that doesn't belong in tissue. And the mind is the body, and the body is the mind. So it's not about healing diseases. It's about paying attention to the energetic dynamics that we're carrying within us, that if they create some sort of pain, turmoil, degeneration, it's feedback to say, okay, here's your unconscious. Now get to work and clean that piece up.
Right.
That's right.
It's all a mirror. It's all a mirror to tell us we've got work to do.
Exactly.
And where we need to place our love.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
well,
where the love,
Michael,
where the actual presence of love needs to be restored.
Yeah,
there you go.
So I'm with you guys 100%. And by the way, the conference, I assume you're talking about the COPTA conference, which we've announced because we're going to be speaking. I think we're speaking. Oh, you're doing a different conference?
Yeah. No, I'm doing another one. I'm in the COPTA conference too. But I'm also, Sasha Stone has a workshop going on in Isla Mujeres, so I'm going to be a presenter there. But, yes, the COPTA conference is really awesome, and you and I are both going to be presenters there.
Yes, and cool if you want to let us know so that anybody that's listening can tune into the other conference you're doing. I'm sure people would love to see what it is you're putting together. It'll certainly have different insights, a different slant, and different learning than what I'm doing. So,
yes, it isn't. I don't think the workshop itself is public; it's private. But I think everything will be recorded, and those will be put out after the workshop. And I'll probably end up making. Post it, I'll make some kind of recording of my presentation. So I'm excited about it. I'm really digging into, you know, how to communicate these precepts to people that aren't familiar with them. And my presentation is different than yours. I'm a little more quantum. I'm a little more into the quantum physics aspect of it. And I'm not a carbon copy of you by any stretch of the imagination, but I love the material. Michael, you came in to do this work, I'm sure, and you really have a gift. You have a gift in this detailed. Were you trying to electronics? Do I remember that right? Electronics.
That was my original work with electronics. Yeah, with a side study in physics and then naturopathy.
Yeah, in your natural medicine, and so you have this mind for this really intricate detail. I mean, I could never have done what you've done, you know, but you've been able to filter this stuff over and over and over and apply it and, you know, really point these things out. It's just it's an amazing body of work. And I just, again, I'm really grateful for it because I can learn from it and I can go out and pass it on from my understanding, but I mean, I'm going to pass it on from my heart and my soul. I believe it's the most important teaching on the planet, you know. And I believe it's the only thing that's going to take us to a viable future, right? So,
what's needed, right? You know? Yeah, and I have the blessing of one of my doctorates is in holistic philosophy. So how does it all work together? You know, when I was doing the electronics work that I did, if you were designing or building or repairing a piece of electronic equipment, it really didn't matter what your philosophy was. It had to work when it came off the other end of the bench. And so whatever I've taken, it's always been, how do I get this down to something that we can hand to someone else and it will work for them? And they don't need special skills. All they have to do is take it and put it to work. So, yeah, I'm with you. And if there's anything, you know, if you want to send me anything that you're putting together for that conference, I'll give you any feedback that I have or what have you, and it'll be a delight to see what unfolds, you know, joining you as, you know, we did 40 years ago. And then, I don't know, it's been, probably 7 or 8 years since we've heard your voice on the show, and it's a delight to have you back and hearing from what you're doing, how you're putting it together in your unique way, because each one of us, you know, offers a way of taking something in and then putting it back out there that can be of benefit to everybody on the team.
Right.
I think
and
they call it holy.
Yeah, I always send people back to your website and the information you put out because you have such a body of knowledge that you put out, and it's incredible. And that you guys have – here I am calling into the same radio show that I called into 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, it's, you know, it's incredible that you guys have consistently just kept putting one foot in front of the other and done this.
I honor your dedication, brother. And
hey,
and
thank you.
Michelle turned us on to the little movie Inside Out, which I can
just
watch.
Oh, isn't that? We were just watching with our granddaughter this morning.
And just deep dive. What was that?
We were just watching Inside Out with my granddaughter this morning. When that movie first came out, I put out to our audience that it is perhaps the most important piece of work that has ever presented itself on the planet, because it takes the really true principles and puts it on a level where a three-year-old can understand it, and anybody from 3 to 100 can understand it and use it, and it's been put out globally in I don't even know how many different languages. Makes it a really important piece of work. I think that movie is profoundly important.
Agreed. Yeah. It has had and still has an impact on my life, and I'm really appreciative of Michelle turning me on to it. She told us that you did your show on that. I don't know how many shows about that after that, and I can see why. It's so in depth. It's so right on. So many levels.
Yeah, we've shown it at intensives at Heartland. I mean, it's a powerful piece of work that they put together. And it looks like a kid's cartoon.
Yeah, Michelle's come and stayed with us a couple times down here in the Yucatan and been delightful. We really enjoyed her presence and her growth and her progress. It's been fun to kind of share the path with her.
She's a good sister.
Sweet.
Speaking of electronics, I just wanted to talk out about body electronics. When you and I both studied with Dr. John Ray and we learned body electronics,
right.
And I literally had a broken arm. Doctors wanted to do surgery and put two bins in around 1982 or so, and I had listened to John Ray's tapes. And so I had my friends, we were really nutritionally sound and we were minerals, and had my friends hold points on me, but the truth is I had to go through the emotional tone scale. I had to clear everything up to love, and literally I just faithfully did that for a few hours while people were holding points on me. Everything that would come up, I would be with it, be in its presence, and breathe, clear it up to love. And within 3 hours, a searing, burning heat went through my arm, and I no longer had a broken arm. And the broken arm literally healed. And so we know the magic of this. It's really being
powerful.
Able to be present and conscious.
There was actually a group out in California that were working with the scale that, and I'm not remembering his name, the fellow who wrote the book on the emotional tone scale.
I think some of it comes from Scientology, but I don't know what else.
No, not related there. No, there was actually a psychiatrist, medical doctor, who did some work in that regard, and he had a scale that went up to 1,000, and there was a group in California working with it, and I took the manuscript to them, and they measured it, and it measured at 985 on their scale of 1,000.
Wow. Nice. Very good. Cool. Well, do we need to give you some time to do closing on your show?
We usually go down to the last few seconds. If there are any other thoughts, any other questions, we'll take it right down to the line.
Oh, man. I'm just really I feel this pull of those Aramaic words on the page, and I am so glad that that there are really good images of all the pages. That's fabulous. I went and looked at the website of the guy who managed to make them, and they're all up at your website, and a person can look at them. And I just wanted to dive into those. I just want to be at one with that vibration coming off the page. I feel like it's really filled with life and a message that's really important.
Well, I breathe with you into it.
Okay.
Because that's one of the key integration points is the breath.
Uh-huh.
I feel that. It is. It's a deep dive, and it's worth the deep dive. Double-click on that, whyagain.org, and dive in there, because my life is transformed, and I honor everything that you're doing and appreciate that. And with that, I'm out. Thank you and bless you.
Cool.
That's my husband's
space.
Motto.
You know, one, One other thought to throw in there is that one of the phrases in Aramaic, Ruach HaKodesh, that the Greeks translate as the Holy Spirit, when you go back to the Old Testament where they talk about, you know, God sent out his spirit, in Aramaic it's not what it says. It was send out the breath. And when we dissociate from the breath, when we cut off from the breath, then we lock into tissue that energy that doesn't belong. And until the breath is restored to that tissue, that energy is not going to be freed, and it will show up as a dis-ease condition. And so restoring the breath throughout the whole structure, and that's where the still point process came from, where when there is a flow of breath that comes to the point where the breath itself spontaneously stops, it's like it opens a space for the super processor to enter and for whatever needs to be moved physiologically to be moved. And that's the point, you know, where that burning, searing pain often happens as the body processes out. You know, in the East they called it Kundalini. I don't believe it's something that resides in the base of the spine. It's simply when we come into proper alignment and a full complement of energy comes through the system, wherever the blocks are, there's going to be that burning, searing pain or Kundalini energy, because that's what needs to be restructured, and that's where the tissue is literally restructured.
Yes, and that still point, reaching that still point is amazing. I encourage people to join your monthly breathing sessions who have an interest. It's really powerful. And what I say in my work is breathe, smile, and love, because we're activating Rachma and Kuba. And I tell people, if you walk away with one thing, just remember to breathe, smile, and love in every situation.
Yeah.
And
right,
you know,
on.
It really, people can grasp it. And I have people write me and say, you know, it's kind of almost become like a mantra out there, a meme, kind of. And I look forward to continuing to get that out there, because I think that just doing that one thing, people can change themselves enough to change the world if they remember that in a situation.
Do you have an actual physical meme of it, a picture that puts that together?
I don't, but I need to make some. It's kind of probably the next
thing
on my
list. We encourage you.
I've gone through.
We encourage you, yeah. Cool. We encourage you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's an awesome way to say
I'll do that. Yes. And it really, I just watch people shift when I always use it at the closing of my shows. And it's just, I feel like it kind of sums up this whole thing into one little thing that if people do it, it'll change them. But digging deeper, of course, really worth it.
You know, I would add two little layers to the top of that meme. I mean, it's right on track, but I would add to it, if, you know, if somebody's in a state of upset, locate the goal, cancel the goal, breathe, smile, restore love.
Beautiful.
And we're back
wow.
to being,
yep.
we're back to the truth of who we are. But if, as long
right.
as we're holding a goal that causes the mind to use dissociated content to produce this construct called perception, then we're going to be stuck in the loop of that perception. So the canceling of the goal, you know, so often people say, well, Michael, this is a perfectly good goal. You know, I just want this person to care for me. Why would I cancel that goal? It's a good goal. It's like, I agree with you. It's a perfectly good goal. The problem isn't the goal. The problem is that when you load it into your mind has hostility and fear around being taken care of or being cherished. And so that hostility or fear is what comes into action. And the way that you clean it out is by identifying the specific, precise goal, canceling the goal, and that's what allows you to drop into the dissociated content, whatever it is in tissue, and remove it from the tissue.
Yes. Excellent. In my slides.
Cool.
Pulling the goal.
Sweet. Yay.
Yeah. Well, listen, lots of love to you guys, and be well, stay well, thrive, live in joy, live in bliss, breathe and smile. And, you know, I think no matter how long the journey is, I mean, I still, like, I was going to sleep last night asking, how do I let go, you know, of everything, anything that's not of love? And it's just continuing to do the work.
And Yeshua gave the key to it. When you find that you're in that space where there's something less than love moving, identify the goal. It may be a goal that's been in your tissue for generations. It may be a goal that just came up in your mind unconsciously 2 minutes ago. But when you identify that goal and specifically and precisely cancel it, that's how to collapse right into the core energy that needs to move. And when you breathe into that core energy and bring the presence of love, boom, that's where the transformation, that's where the forgiveness takes place.
That's great.
Beautiful.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All right. Appreciate both of you. Nice to connect. And if there's any more that comes up or more conversation to be had, let's continue the conversation tomorrow.
Will do. Absolutely. Thanks
All right.
so much.
Blessings.
Gracias.
Everybody, thank
Bye.
You for joining
Gracias.
Us. The best year yet of your eternal life. Remember, there are, I don't know, we're getting up probably close to 4,000 hours. This conversation to go on 5 days a week for 10 years. And go to the archives, pick it up, and pass it along. In the meantime, create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. You can give it. The world needs it. Blessings. Bye-bye.